We're going to get started. Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee will be called to order. We don't yet have a quorum. Today is February 26th. Representative Thiessen, we are going to have you come forward and explain your bill, and then as soon as we get a quorum, we will formally move your bill. So welcome to the committee, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The legislation before you is taking money from a current fund that we have today that's partly funded by a general fund appropriation of a few hundred thousand dollars each biennium, but it's actually much larger because it has a corpus, if you will, of money that has been invested. That's actually lost some of its value, as you might imagine, over the last several months, but there's about $5 million or so dollars in that fund. And what it's used for currently is the Cooper Sams. It's basically a penchant for volunteer first medical response units and people who do that. So people who have served as a volunteer in those type of units can kind of get some money after they've served a certain amount of time. And in the past, this money has been grabbed for the general fund to balance the budget. In 08 it was, for instance. And so what the proposal here is today is to take some of that money, which won't jeopardize the ability over the long term to pay out these what are essentially pension benefits, and to use those monies for very specific one-time purposes that in this budget time will help the ambulance and emergency response folks in general. And there's five of them that you can see listed here. I think it would make sense if Mr. Doyle would like to come down and kind of explain in a little more detail. Is that how you want to do it, or do you just want me to do it?
You can have whoever come forward or represent Stephen, but we don't have necessarily the finance portion, and the only reason why this is really within the jurisdiction of our committee is because it's directing the Department of Public Safety to do something.
Okay.
And so,
well, I'll talk about that study then, if that's what you
that
want.
That would be very
great.
Helpful.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. What the study does, and it's actually a pilot program, and what that would do is we have a problem or a challenge that my city, for instance, Richfield, and many other cities around the state have, where the fire department serves as really their main job these days, and the most of the work they do is actually to be first responders. So they'll be the first on the scene if there's a 911 call, like someone's falling down on the street or someone's having a heart attack, and then the ambulance will kind of come after the fact. And the ambulance gets reimbursed through the insurance system. You know, so if you have an ambulance come, your Blue Cross or whoever will pay for that. The first responders show up, they're not ever reimbursed. There's no kind of insurance reimbursement for the first responders that get. And very often, those first responders can triage the situation, making the fact that there's really no need for the ambulance ultimately to get there. They can either find out the person is actually okay, you know, there's a 911 call, but they've recovered, or that they can kind of do some of the treatment in advance. And so what we want to, the premise is that those first responders actually save the system a lot of money, but they're under a lot of stress right now. But we don't have the facts to back that up. And so what we'd like to do with this study is to kind of run some pilot programs. We actually set up a reimbursement system for first responders and then track and see, does it save us money? Do we get a better health care outcome in terms of kind of the way people can survive? And then collect data so we can go forward and look at options for perhaps finding some funding for these folks either through the insurance system or through some other type of system. So that's what we're trying to get, is to try to support these first responders, which are critical in our communities, but because of a whole variety of issues, an aging population, the fact that we have, you know, tough budget times, and that they're responding more and more to these non-fire type emergencies, but these medical emergencies, which require different equipment and different training and different skills, that we figure out, looking forward into the future, we figure out a way to kind of support those folks. That's kind of what the pilot's about.
Great. Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Thiessen, I just have two questions. Sometimes the terminology of paid on call and volunteer are used very liberally. Is this paid on call? Like, my department is, they're not a full-time response. They do have some full-timers, but my department is more of a part-time. They're not volunteer. I just want to clarify for the representative.
And that's a good question. And for the people that could be in this pilot program, it could be professional departments. It could be volunteer departments, or it could be an interim. The legislation for the pilot is not going to, it doesn't kind of distinguish among those. I think the idea is it'll be geographically spread around. So we have some urban ones. It's 5 programs. Some greater Minnesota ones, and then probably some diversity of how they structure themselves. Are they professional, fire departments like Richfield, or are they volunteer, or somewhere in between? Okay. Does that answer your question?
We officially have a quorum, so I will formally call this meeting to order. And Representative Olin.
I would move House File 161 and would also refer to Bynoski.
Representative Olin moves that House File 161 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. So, Representative Bingham, you had an additional question.
Yeah, just one other question. How are the organizations going to be chosen?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And I think the way that they're going to, it'll be chosen through this, through the Department of Public Safety Consulting, as you see in 1.11 through 1.13. The organizations listed there will get together and decide who's going to be chosen, with the understanding that there's going to be a diversity between the metro and greater Minnesota and different types of first responder services. But we're talking mostly here about fire departments, I think.
Okay, thank you. Further questions from members? Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, our representative just doesn't have anything, maybe I should ask him this minute, firefighters in minute. This doesn't have anything to do with the old miles, this minute, with a $400,000 study and all that.
Representative Cornish, could you please speak into your microphone?
I know you love to hear me. Madam Chair and members, I just wanted to know if this had anything to do with that big hubbub that we had about that study and the $400,000 to do with the pension, but it doesn't sound like it.
This is not the Spring Lake Park, Madam Chair. This is not that at all.
Oh,
yes.
Sounds good.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing that, Representative Thiessen, right now we just have the recommendation that it go to finance because we don't know which finance division it is.
We're just talking about that, and we don't either. Yeah.
Okay. So, Representative Tamar, you might want to look and see if this would have to come to you because it does direct the Department of Public Safety to do something. So you might want to take a look. Right now it's just generically going to be sent to finance.
And I know that Representative Junkie also wants to see it, but we can go both places if the chairs need to do that. So.
All right. All those in favor, Representative Olin renews his motion that House File 161 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, members.
Next on the agenda is Representative Bingham. Representative Bingham moves that House File 971 be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill. Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a departmental bill that from the Department of Public Safety that was brought to me, and yes, it does have to do with sex offenders. So I will Superintendent O'Malley from the BCA go through the bill.
Superintendent O'Malley, welcome to the committee. Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tim O'Malley, I'm the superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. 971 is a bill that what we're seeking to do is clarify what was the legislature's intent, I guess, going back a few years. There's two bills here today before this committee that deal with predatory offenders. Both stem from legislation in the year 2000, the Katie Poyer bills that came about. The first one deals with clarifying the restarting of registration periods. And what's been discovered is over the years, there have been some seemingly inconsistencies in the way this could be applied. And prosecutors have come to us and asked us to help clarify that. If you look at the bill at the bottom of it, on page one there, the really key phrases are the two phrases, one where it says subsequently incarcerated, and then secondly, following conviction. Those are the two phrases, and if I can just give a couple examples, Madam Chair. Regarding following conviction, if a person is required to register, for example, for a 10-year period from 1998 to 2008, and say they are arrested with about 2 years left in their registration period, so in 1996 they get arrested for a DWI, and they are convicted. and they're required to serve 60 days. If that happens and they're convicted and they serve their 60 days when they get out, then that 10-year period starts over again. That seems real clear that that's what the legislature intended, that if when somebody's registered during that period of registration, if they break any laws at all, that they need to start the registration period over. The problem comes if, say, the same person or someone is arrested with 2 years to go and they flee. They leave the jurisdiction, and they're finally arrested 3 years later and they're brought back, and then they're convicted. Because they were not convicted nor incarcerated during the period of their registration, they would not have to re-register. Another example to drive this home, and this has happened recently, someone is arrested with maybe 6 months to go in the registration period, and in one case the person fled and wasn't caught for a while, the first person I described, or secondly they will get continuances and make sure that their conviction only occurs after the registration period ends. So there's an incentive for them to delay the legal process so that they can wait until afterwards. And that is the following conviction element of this. So the goal here was to change the law so that if someone commits an offense during the registration period, that's what would trigger the re-registration, regardless of when the conviction occurred or when the incarceration occurred.
Questions from members? Representative Jackson.
I'm just curious why rather than the time period, and maybe in current law the 10-year starts all over for a sex offense, but if it doesn't, why not that trigger it instead of any offense? I mean, a lot come to mind that are so unrelated.
Superintendent O'Malley.
Madam Chair, members, that's the law that was passed in 2000. This doesn't change that part of it at all. The decision back in 2000 was that if someone, while they're registered, they break the law in any way, the legislature passed a law that said that means that they're going to serve. Their expectation while you're registering is that you will be law abiding. And if it is a subsequent sexual offense, even after they're off registration, you're right, then they would have to register as a sex offender at that point.
Jackson.
Then what is the substantive difference between that law and this?
Superintendent O'Malley.
Madam Chair, members, there's really two differences here, and the first one that we're talking about is the concept of the law as written today is that only if a person is convicted of a crime while in a registered status does their time start over. So it seems that an incentive is in place to encourage those who may commit an offense to either delay that conviction or even abscond so that they're not convicted, technically convicted, until the day after the registration period ends. And therefore, people who act identically will be treated differently. If I'm arrested for an offense and convicted within a week, and that's within my registration period, then I have to register. You know, if it's a 5-year period, then I have to start over. On the other hand, if the exact same event occurs to someone else who's a registrant and they flee for a year and come back, then they don't have to register.
All right. Representative Johnson.
I'll pass. Madam Chair, he answered my question.
Representative West.
Thank you. Superintendent O'Malley, this is something that I'm guessing I should probably know, but don't. In a case where you've got sexual offense conduct, in some cases, you have, say, harassment and stalking, where a person is, you know, stalking an individual, and that's a crime that occurs over, it's a pattern crime, and it happens over a series of periods of time. How does it impact if there isn't a specific incident that triggers it, but there's a series of incident that is the cause for the crime? Where do we say that the conduct occurred? I mean, is it any period within the 10 years? If it straddles at the end of the 10-year period, how would we handle that? Do you follow what I'm asking?
Superintendent O'Malley.
Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, I do. Again, under current law, it wouldn't matter. It's only the conviction. Under what you're describing, though, if there's a pattern of activity, if there's even a conspiracy period that starts on a certain date and ends after the registration period ends, that conduct, part of that conduct would have taken place during the registration period, and under the proposed language, that would still apply then, I believe.
Okay. Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, so Superintendent O'Malley, I'm just trying to get your opinion on, I mean, I understand you're trying to get clarification of what the original statute was, but, you know, when we have some high-profile cases in the state, we tend to enact all kinds of laws, and I'm just wondering what your, if you can offer an opinion about this. I mean, it does, it's following up on an earlier question, I mean, I understand, you know, it just seems like to me, you know, a relatively minor offense that you got arrested for. Now you have, if I understand it correctly, under current law and what you're proposing, someone would have to register as a sex offender for another 10 years under a relatively minor offense. I mean, I'm just trying to get at how that's helpful and what we're intending to do here. I'm not sure that. You know, it seems over the top to me. I mean, I could see certain offenses being that you would want to do that for, certainly any kind of a burglary or something that sort of fit the original crime, whatever that sex offense might have been. And I don't know the answer to this, but now that we've been away from when the bill been away from this for a while, does this really make sense, or we need to think this through at all, or
Superintendent O'Malley?
Madam Chair and Representative, my opinion is that I think it does make sense. It's not just for an arrest; it's for a conviction. So if someone is convicted at a time when they're registering, and it's for the period of their initial registration. It's not automatically 10 years or whatever. If their original registration was 10 years, then it starts over at 10. And it's not just any conviction. There has to be incarceration and not just a booking incarceration. You have to have been convicted of an offense that results in an incarceration for that offense. So when I use an example of a DWI, if there is no time served, that wouldn't trigger this. So it's not jaywalking. It's an offense that when a person is in a registration status that results in a conviction and secondly incarceration as a result, you know, a penalty for that conviction. The decision was made then, and I don't disagree with it, that persons who have been convicted of an offense that requires registration, that they should remain law-abiding during the registration period.
Madam Chair, to that point.
Representative West.
Good. Thank you. And I just wanted to just lift up some of my concerns. One of those high-profile cases was Drew Shadeen, and if people recall, Alfonso Rodriguez was an individual who was sentenced under the old indeterminate sentencing program we had prior to the 2005 law change, and the court jurisdiction had elapsed on him. For certain individuals who maybe screw up once, I think, and they've served their time, paid their debt to society, I absolutely agree with Representative Paymar. But for many of these people, remember that it's extraordinarily difficult to get a conviction. The standard is high. You got to have a unanimous jury. The deck is stacked against the state, despite some people may think. We got to have our evidence all in order. And if these people continue to screw up, I think there's a strong case to be made to keep them under scrutiny. And re-registering, I don't think it's too onerous, especially when they have been duly convicted by a jury of their peers of something as onerous as a CSC or one of those laws. So that's, I just believe that Alfonso Rodriguez is one of the reasons why we should have an option to keep these people under scrutiny.
Okay. Representative Paymar.
To the superintendent or Representative West, I don't see this. Is this for level 3 sex offenders or all sex offenders?
Superintendent O'Malley.
Or are you?
Madam Chair, and this is for all those who have to register. So this is all sex offenders that have to register.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. O'Malley, how many people do you think are we talking about here that would fall under this situation where they may be arrested and having to re-register again?
Superintendent O'Malley.
Madam Chair and Representative, are you referring to how many people would be affected as a result of the change?
Right, and the change in the law you're proposing.
Superintendent O'Malley.
Madam Chair, members, I don't think many would be affected at all. I'm aware of 3 or 4 cases where this has happened, where someone fled, and then by the time they were arrested, the effect would be that they wouldn't have to register, whereas if they hadn't fled, they would have had to register. And I'm aware of two cases in which there were a series of continuances, and it's my understanding from the prosecutors that their belief is those were employed as a way to get beyond the registration period. So I don't... one of our concerns, or the prosecutor's concerns really, is that this will become known and we will see more and more of this, and it will just delay justice in those cases, or people will be encouraged to flee for a short period of time.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Miller, so people beyond will likely be supervised for as a predatory offender longer in some cases, is that correct?
Superintendent O'Malley.
Madam Chair, members, this isn't really supervision. That would be a separate issue of whether they have a probation officer assigned to them or not. This is purely registration. This is purely the once a year they've got to make sure they check in with us. We need to have on record for police use only. You know, this is not the public website. This is just that they need to stay registered with their local law enforcement agency and in terms of the BCA, so we have a record of their, for example, their place of employment, their home, their vehicles, those kinds of things.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Bingham renews her motion that House File 971 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus public safety omnibus bill. Bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Bingham. Superintendent O'Malley, why don't you just stay there and I'll present that bill next. Representative Bingham.
Representative Hillstrom, when you get up there, if you'd like to move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 792 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Public Safety Bill.
And, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Representative O'Malley, or Superintendent O'Malley, as they are the ones that brought me this bill.
Let's see, you've been called Commander Representative. So, Superintendent O'Malley, proceed with the explanation of the bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is another one in which we seek clarification. Under this statute, if a person who has previously been convicted of a sex offense but is not required to register, the example here would be someone convicted in, say, 1988, prior to the registration law going into effect. There was a law passed again back in 2000 that says if that person who was previously convicted of a sex offense but is not required to register now, if that person is convicted of a crime against a person, if that person is now convicted of a crime against a person offense, and it lists what those are, then that person now has to register as a sex offender. And what's been found out is that our belief is that it was inadvertent, but one statutory citation for crimes against a person was left out of there, and that is that if it's the one that deals with a felon being in possession of a machine gun. So if right now, if someone who is a sex offender, convicted of a sex offense, I should say, in the mid-1980s, and is now convicted in 2009 for possession of a felon in possession of a handgun, they would have to register. If they were convicted of possession of a felon in possession of a machine gun, they would not. That's the inconsistency that seems to be there. And I think it's just because 609.67, which is the possession of a machine gun, was inadvertently left off the list.
That's the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Representative Mason.
I just have a question clarifying guns. So you have to list all the guns rather than just using guns, period, or rifles?
Superintendent O'Malley.
Madam Chair and members, I don't know that you have to list all the guns, but I think in this case, specificity overrules the general. So if the statute is that a felon cannot be in possession of a gun, but there's a separate one that says possession of a machine gun because that's more narrowly defined, that's what they could be charged under. And if they're actually convicted of that, because that's not listed here, it's based on their conviction. So if they're convicted of 609.67 and it's not specifically listed, it doesn't apply.
Any other questions from members? Seeing none, is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify in favor or against the bill today? Seeing none, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 792 be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety policy omnibus bill. The bill is laid over.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And the next bill on the agenda is your bill 2, Representative Hillstrom, of 695. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 695 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Justice Committee.
Okay, sounds good. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill also was brought to me, and I didn't write down your name. I apologize. So, Madam Chair, I have a testifier, and I'd like to have her introduce herself because I didn't write down her name.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Testifier, please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and Representatives, I am Cheryl Parrish, Todd County Recorder, here representing the local registrars of Minnesota today.
Welcome to the committee, and please explain the bill.
Our first, the first item is to change and require that both legal custodial parents need to approve for a their child to be married between the ages of 16 and 18. It provides a format for the consent form, creates it, and puts it into statute. And then it also updates the wording. There's no longer juvenile courts. They are district courts. So we would like to get that updated. On 517.03 subdivision 2, it's changing court administrator, which used to handle the marriages, now the local registrars. That was previously changed in past years through the legislature, and this was omitted at that time. On 517.04, the solemnization, it changes the header to persons authorized to perform marriages, because within statute 517, there are three different areas that say solemnization. We feel that that better reflects that. And puts an age restriction onto who can perform marriages. We believe that as presently, anyone can obtain ordinations through the computer, and currently statute says judges, retired judges, court administrators, and such can perform marriages. We feel that most of the time those are going to be at least 21 years of age. We feel that there is, it's vital to put a restriction as to the age of a person to perform marriages. 517.05, credentials of ministers. What we're finding is that the Amish do not issue ordinations to their people that can perform marriages. And so this is just going to modernize that, and that if their religious, spiritual religious assembly does not demand credentials, then at least an authorization from their assembly be presented. Another housekeeping within that is court administrator to local registrar. Another one within that is a certificate of filing. What we would do is, let me read that one for sure. Oh, is this clarifying? Because current statute says that they will be given a certificate, and this would create a form called a certificate of filing. Basically, it would identify that credential or that requirement, and then the person signs that filing that they have complied or feel that what they're presenting covers that statute. The next one, parties examined, is inserting the requirement that a person who is going to perform a marriage make sure that a marriage license has been obtained and that the individuals in front of them are the people listed on the license. The next one is the license by 517.07. This is pretty self-explanatory, but it seems like we know that the legislature only can rule things that happen in Minnesota. But we have had instances where individuals bought the license in Minnesota, went to a different state and got married and brought it back. The Attorney General's office at that time suggested that we might want to come and get that clarified, that it's a Minnesota license to be used within the geographical boundaries of Minnesota. The next one, line 4.4, is a requirement that both parties need to apply for the license. What we're finding, we've had incidents where an individual will come and ask if there was a marriage for so-and-so. Yes, there has been. That's me, and I was never at the wedding. So it's important enough, and there's felony questions, there are social security numbers, there's number of marriages. Maybe the one applying doesn't know all the information about the other one. So it's just a requirement to make both come in and apply. Then on line 4.14, we're collecting the children, names and birth dates of children born between the couple. It's being collected, which makes the application a data private thing because of the question being asked. The local registrars are collecting it, but they're not giving it to anyone. And so we did have a discussion with the Minnesota Department of Health state registrar. He had no objection to us removing it. And we also talked to the County Attorney's Association, I believe the Juvenile Division or something, and they were in agreement. If we're collecting it and not giving it to anyone, why collect it? On line 4.21, I guess I would like to ask Hennepin County representative to come and address this.
Yep, please come up to the microphone and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Jeffrey Schmitz, and I work for Hennepin County.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Proceed.
Madam Chair, representatives, this particular provision, the Hennepin County would support in that right now we kind of have a problem in that, you know, the state law requires that you have to have a social security number to in order to get married. That's what the technical provision of the law actually says. We were practicing the policy that if you did not have a social security number, we were not accepting applications. And litigation was brought to Hennepin County, and as a result, we have been taking applications now without a social security number. So there's a little bit of inconsistency between what the state law says and what the provisions of the agreement of the lawsuit was. So this helps protect, this provision helps change the inconsistencies in what's actually being done and what the state law says. And it also brings us in, there are many other counties that are doing that as well, and that's the reason why we're here is to say there's an inconsistency that needs to be addressed.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue with the explanation of the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Madam Chair and Representatives, if we go to line 4.29 of the bill, currently it's saying that a person who's convicted is a felon cannot change their surname through marriage. If the felon was to go to the court and do a court-ordered name change, it specifically says they cannot change their name. So if you have Mary Ann Doe, who is a felon, comes in and gets a marriage license and changes her name to Alice Jean Doe, she's complying with the statute. You're going to lose that individual within the system because the first and middle name are different. So basically that's just kind of tying it into the same as what the court-ordered name change is. And if we go to 4.34, we needed to, because we were requiring two of them to come in and apply, we realized that in some instances that's not going to be able to be done. We needed to set up an option, and the option we came up with is that the one would apply, give the missing applicant's information, the local registrar would make a copy of that license. That copy would need to go to the person who did not appear. They would certify that the information is correct. That certification would come back in, and then we could issue the license.
And
Madam Chair, I think the rest of these other provisions really are civil law except Section 11 with the penalty.
Okay.
So I think...
Okay. Do you want to proceed to Section 11?
We could skip to Section 11.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hilstrom, Representative Cornish has a question.
Madam Chair, and to the testifier, do you want to back up to 4.21 about marriage application, Social Security number? Maybe I'm getting a little paranoid here, but I'm thinking the whole line here, and just tell me if I'm, maybe legal can help me if, on this, is there any conspiracy theory here? If an illegal alien comes into the country, are they granted any extra benefits or citizenship if they get married to somebody? And who would be the person that wouldn't have a Social Security number if they're going to get married? Would this help that effort on along if they were trying to do this? And just give you an idea of what the typical profile of a person is when they come in. Who are they that wouldn't have a Social Security number? Is it somebody that's really elderly and wouldn't have, you know, applied when... So just talk about that, sir.
Ms. Parrish?
Madam Chair and Representative, the Amish, many of the Amish do not have Social Security numbers. It might be an illegal alien, and statute doesn't require them to be a U.S. citizen to apply and get married here. And so what we did is, ideally it would be to take the requirement out, because again, we collect it, but we don't share it with anyone. But if we realize it's a federal requirement, so it has to be collected. So knowing that, we thought, how do we get around that? And so we followed what the Department of Public Safety on their driver's license application form has. It's a box that you check that you certify you do not have a Social Security number.
Representative Cornish, do you have a follow-up?
Nope.
Representative Hilstrom, would you like to respond?
That's fine.
Okay, and then there is one more. Representative Paymer?
Are you done with your testimony? I have a question on line on a different section of the bill.
Well, Ms. Pierce, do you want to continue the testimony when you come back to Representative Paymer?
Madam Chair and Representatives, I would just comment on number 11, and then definitely would be willing to talk about anything else. The penalty. Current statute says that the officiant needs to deliver and file a certificate. What we're having is, in many times, the officiant is delivering, but it's not able to be filed because they don't have the place of their credentials inserted, so it needs to go back. This statute, the fine, has been there for many years. I don't know that any of the local registrars have actually used it, but what this would do, it would enable them to, if there was a habitual abuser, it's requiring that they file it with us, and we can't file it if it's incomplete. And so if a habitual abuser does that, the local registrar would be able to collect the $100.
Okay. That's it. Anything else, Representative Wilson?
That's it.
Okay, Representative Paymar, to your question.
I'm just wondering on, and this could, you can get me the answer to this between now and then I'm going to Chair Mullery's committee, but the on 517.05 credentials of ministers. It speaks on line 3.16. It starts on 3.15, or if the religious denomination does not have issue credentials, doesn't sound right, but authority from the minister's spiritual assembly. Have you checked this out with different religious entities in the state of Minnesota to see if this? I'll tell you why I'm asking this question, as I got into a bit of trouble a couple of years ago, and I still think we were right, but it was a couple of years ago when Senator Scoglin and I were trying to, we were the authors of the month marriage bill, and I got to know more about marriages than I think that I wanted to about it. But the, in the month, I think it's called the Qigong. I think that actually solemnizes marriages in the Hmong community. I don't know that they, you know, I don't know if you've checked this out, but if they actually have a spiritual assembly where that could be verified, it's sort of a cultural thing that goes back generations, where the family hires this spiritual advisor who then, in essence, solemnizes the marriage, if I remember correctly. I'm just wondering if this fits for them, or if there's other religions I'm just wondering if we're not creating something here that maybe you weren't intending.
Ms. Parrish?
Madam Chair and representatives, we haven't checked with other religious denominations. We're open to ideas, but we felt by calling them spiritual assemblies, it would be broad enough to cover everyone and not individualize a specific orientation. So that's kind of where we had come up with spiritual assembly, because we wanted to be able to fit the needs of the Amish, the Hmong, the whatever, you know, that we're not familiar with.
And Representative Hilstrom for the comment.
Representative Paymar, I don't know the answer to that one completely, but we will find out the answer to that between now and the next committee.
Right.
And Senator Butzold is also carrying it in the Senate, so I will make certain that we chat with him about it as well. Because I do remember the debate about the Hmong marriage. I was on the committee then, and so I remember it very clearly.
Okay.
And then Representative Mullery had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, no, I was just going to say that I see Mr. Gehring back there. And I'm not sure if you were the one that got stuck in the middle of that, but I remember that very well. And I think, as I recall, there's another statute that in some way refers to it, and I remember what you're talking about very much, Representative Tamar, and I thought there was a statute that broke down, unless we changed it in your committee or whatever committee that was a couple years ago, that broke down different ways that different types of religion were, and I don't see that statute in here anymore. It must be someplace else. Mr. Gehring, right?
I was going to say, and Representative Mullery, we'd be happy to make certain that we reference that in your committee, because I think that is really more about the civil definitions and things rather than this. But if you wanted to, you can come and
okay.
And
Representative Hilstrom,
it has been brought to my attention, and we will make certain that the group that brought me this bill takes a look.
Okay. Any other questions from Representative Ruskowski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hilstrom and Ms. Parrish, I want to go back to the section that Representative Cornish pointed out, 4.21 through 4.23. Ms. Parrish, if you would just review for us again. I think you had said that the Social Security number is really never referenced or used. If you would just kind of verify that. And then in the language there on line 4.22, it says the party must certify. So in the event that someone does not have a Social Security number, exactly how would they certify? Basically signing above a line that says, hey, I don't have a Social Security number? Or could you address that?
Ms. Parrish?
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, presently everyone is following the direction of their legal counsel, all local registrars in every county. 87 counties throughout the state, some are following the strict words of what the statute says, that you must have the Social Security number. Those counties have the chance of going through what Hennepin County did. Some county attorneys are advising, I know what the intent behind the law was, so let's follow the intent rather than what the actual statute says. Many of us local registrars don't feel comfortable with that because we want to follow the statute fully. And so to follow what the requirement is, because it's a federal mandate, we needed to find a way of doing that. So we went back to an established procedure already, which is the driver's license application. On that driver's license application, you have to submit your driver's license, your social security number, or there's a box. I certify that I do not have a social security number. They actually sign the application, much as they will be doing the same with the application for the marriage.
Follow-up, Representative Ruskowski?
Actually, an unrelated question, Madam Chair, if I could. Ms. Parrish, I'm just curious. Page 1, line point 1-1, the addition of legal custodial in there, I'm curious as to what types of abnormalities may have brought this to your attention.
Ms. Parrish, Madam Chair and Representative, we had one instance that comes to mind, and it's very fresh because it happened to me. A mother and a daughter, 16-year-old, came to the office to get an application for the minor to marry. We sent them off to the court. We said, inquiring. We said, are both mom and dad in favor of this? Oh, yes, yes. Dad's away. He's trucking. And so we sent them off to the judge. The judge granted the order for the minor to marry. They came back, we issued the license. A week later, we had one very, very mad father because he did not approve of his 16-year-old daughter getting married. So what happened is the county local registrar and the judge ended up being in between a family fight. The intent of the legal custodial parent is we want that the discussions and the approval to come at home before they come to the county and get the judge and the county involved. We understand that in some instances it might be a divorced couple. Maybe mom has custody of the child. The child gets mad at mom, I'm going to go live with dad for a little while. Dad says, sure, you can marry your boyfriend. Dad, the non-custodial parent, and the child get the license, the child gets married. The legally custodial parent who was awarded that through the court had no knowledge of it. And so that's kind of the intent behind it, is we want everyone to talk about this and understand the consequences and then come to the county.
And Representative Ruskowski, this is more of the legal, civil law stuff, I'm sorry, but is that what you were going to say?
Well, no, I was just going to point out that Madam Chair and Ms.
Parrish,
you may end up with quite a issue on this. You're taking away the rights of a parent, it would seem, and I'm trying to remember back when I handled a lot of divorces, but what falls within legal custodial, what falls within physical custodial, and what falls within the realm of the rights of parents, overriding that, and I don't know if that's the way the courts are treating it now, that a custodial parent, right now it's with the consent of the person's parents, and you're taking away the right of a parent to consent to this, and I can see a huge issue that you are just going through here like this is just a small bill. This issue will make this bill into maybe an enormous issue, because I think there's a lot of parents that are going to be concerned that they lose that right that you're taking away from them.
Representative Mueller, and that's in your committee,
right,
too, in civil law. So, Representative Wilson, did you have any final comments to wrap up?
Madam Chair, I just was going to comment to Representative Mueller. I'd be happy to work with whomever and have the people who brought me this bill to work with whomever they should, because it, again, they brought it to me with the intent that they wanted to do some cleaning up. They wanted to, you know, do some streamlining. And if there are pitfalls for someone who's not ever carried a marriage bill before, I'm happy to, you know, listen to your advice.
Madam Chair, that's why I was letting them know that I'm sure that one of them sits on the other committee, and
I'll ask one more time if there are any final questions, comments from members. And then is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify in favor or opposed to the bill? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Hilstrom renews her motion that House File 695 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Civil Justice Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
One more thing we have are the minutes from the February 24th. I would need a motion to approve those minutes. Representative Draskowski makes that motion. All in favor says aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Meeting is adjourned.